Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy McPoor. This week, we're visiting the 31st Annual Camden Conference, which aims to explore the state of foreign affairs amid shifts in global powers and the role of the U.S. in the changing world. Today, we'll hear two talks about this year's Camden Conference theme, New World Disorder and America's Future. In the first half, we'll hear from Evan Medeiros, Managing Director for Asia at the Eurasia Group, for a talk titled Politics, Nationalism, and Their Impact on U.S.-China Relations and China's Role. Afterwards, we'll join Cleo Pascal, a geopolitical expert at the Royal Institute of International Affairs based in London. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and you can access it on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to hear this program at your convenience, and you can access many past Speaking in Maine programs. You can also find this program as a podcast. And now, Evan Medeiros takes the stage.
So today, we're going to talk about China. So to begin, can I see a show of hands? How many people have been to China before, traveled to China? That includes Taiwan, Hong Kong. Okay, great. Sounds like we've got... Anybody speak Chinese? Any Chinese speakers in the audience? Ambassador Chaz Freeman doesn't count. Okay. Great. How about students studying Chinese in any of the universities here in Maine? Okay, I don't see too many there. Well, so when we talk about China, I think that the best place to begin is I want to begin with a little story. And it goes back to my time at the National Security Council. Because working at the NSC, it's just relentless. We used to call it a sprint-a-thon. In other words, it's a sprint within a marathon every day. You're working 14-plus hours. It just never stops. So my little respite at the NSC was on the fifth floor of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building is this beautiful old library. It actually used to be the State Department Library when the State Department was housed in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. And so I would go there because it was the only quiet place where I could gather my thoughts and just sort of take a deep breath. And one day when I was sitting there decompressing, I noticed a book, picked it up, and it had the transcript of this fascinating conversation in 1969 between new U.S. President Nixon and the head of the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Leonid Brezhnev. Fascinating conversation. And it's very instructive for today's presentation. So Brezhnev had been head of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union for about 5 years. Richard Nixon had been president a few months. And, you know, Brezhnev, being a good Soviet, all he wanted to do was coerce Nixon, sort of take the measure of the man, see if he could push him around. So they get on the phone, and Brezhnev just starts really aggressive out of the gates. He said, "Mr. President, my intelligence people tell me that you have satellites that can actually read the letters on license plates of cars parked at the Kremlin." And, you know, Nixon, being the new president, he didn't want to give away state secrets, sort of breathing heavily. And he says, "Yeah, that's right, we do. And we use it to capture as many national security secrets of the Soviet Union as possible." So Brezhnev, you know, got a strong pushback. So Brezhnev says, "You know what, Mr. President? My intelligence agencies tell me that you actually have submarines that are not only nuclear-powered, but can fire ballistic missiles to hit the Soviet Union." So, you know, Nixon, wanting to keep pace with Brezhnev, said, "You know what, Mr. President? That's right. We actually do. And all of those missiles are pointed at you, the Soviet Union." So, of course, you know, Brezhnev's getting very, very tense here. And so Brezhnev, you know, pulls out what he thought was his trump card. He says, "Mr. President, my best intelligence guys tell me that you have a machine that can predict the future." So Nixon, you know, he's thinking, "My God, this is the most heavily classified, super-duper, mega-special access program. How does he know we have the computer that can predict the future because it's actually housed right here in the White House?" And so, of course, Nixon doesn't miss a beat. He says, "Yep, we do. We've got it." And Brezhnev says, "Mr. President, I don't believe you. I want you to tell me, ask the machine, who is going to be the head of the Soviet Union in the year 2000? So Nixon says, "Okay, got it. puts down the phone, walks down the hall, and back then computers were all punch cards. Everybody here remember punch cards? This crowd will remember punch cards. Some people remember floppy disks, you remember the punch cards. So walks down the hall, chick, 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 ding. You know, little bell goes off when computers had bells. Punch card pops out, he walks down the hall. And so Nixon's sort of breathing very heavily on the phone, and Brezhnev says, "Well, what does it say?" Nixon doesn't say anything, keeps breathing. Brezhnev says, "Ha, I told you so. This machine doesn't work." And Nixon says, "No, the problem is I can't read the name. It's written in Chinese." So, of course, that raises the question, what is China's rise all about? You simply cannot have a conversation about the most consequential variable in international relations without trying to understand what it means. I've got six different ideas that I hope that you keep in mind in thinking about China's rise. Number one is context. It's important when thinking about China's rise to look at both strengths and weaknesses. And I say that because the media constantly bombards us with images of China's strengths, and they are substantial. A large and rapidly growing economy, second largest economy in the world, $12 trillion at market exchange rates, growing at somewhere between 6 to 6.5%. If current trajectories continue, it will exceed the size in market exchange rate terms of the U.S. economy, probably around 2030, but it depends on the rates. China has a large and rapidly modernizing military. It spends most on its military next to the United States, but it's a very distant second. The U.S. is at about $600 billion. China is roughly about $180 to $200 billion. And its military is acquiring a lot of very fancy, sophisticated equipment that is going to make it a lot more difficult. In fact, it's already making it much more difficult for the U.S. to project power. So China is the world's largest exporter, having surpassed Germany in, I think, about 2015. There are 100 countries in the world for which China is their top exporter. The United States is around in the high 1950s. China has a global diplomatic footprint. There's not a region of the world in which China is not present and active, and in some cases quite influential, of course, certainly in the Asia-Pacific. And China's emerging as a rapid IT superpower, right? Anybody heard of Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, right? I mean, when it comes to major information technologies, China is at the cutting edge. So we hear a lot about the strengths. Those are important. Don't forget about the weaknesses and balance those two out. What are the weaknesses? China has huge structural economic imbalances at the heart of its economy. It has a large and inefficient state-owned sector. China has a large and growing debt. Debt as a percentage of GDP is about 280% and growing at roughly 10 to 12% per year, which for a developing country, not developed country like the United States or Japan, for a developing country that has a closed capital account and a highly managed exchange rate, that's a very, very problematic figure. China has huge demographic challenges. Simply put, China is going to grow old before it grows rich, simply because the working age population is now shrinking as the aging population is growing much more rapidly. In terms of sustaining a viable workforce that will drive growth, that presents a huge challenge. Massive income inequality in China. China has one of the largest Gini coefficients for its class of economies. China has huge environmental problems, air and water pollution. According to the Asia Development Bank, 7 of the 10 most polluted cities in the world are in China. 7 of the 10 most polluted cities in the world are in China. China has problems with its ethnic minorities. The Muslim Uyghurs in Xinjiang province in the West, the Tibetans in the Tibetan autonomous regions, Taiwan and Hong Kong continue to be uncomfortable with their relationship with China. And then, of course, as Steve Walt told us yesterday, China's very, very heavily dependent on imported oil and gas, and that dependence is growing, not declining. So that was a long way of making a very, very important point. Look at both sides of the balance sheet, because you're always going to be presented with one side of the balance sheet. Point number two, uncertainty. China's future is profoundly uncertain. It is not inevitable that China is going to be a global superpower. And I know this very very viscerally from my time at the NSC, because when we talked about doing future planning on China, we had to deal with both upside risks and downside risks simultaneously. In other words, the uncertainty about China is just not garden variety uncertainty that it's difficult to predict where any country is going to go. It's a very particular type of uncertainty because you can craft scenarios in which China is both a large economy with a modernizing military with a big footprint that represents a huge challenge, or a China that doesn't get its act together, doesn't address the structural economic, social, and political challenges at the heart of their society, and as a result, growth sort of gradually declines, plateaus, sort of China becomes like Japan. So you have both upside and downside risks at the same time, and it's very difficult to know what China's future is going to be. The diversity of the challenge posed by China's rise. It's not the Soviet Union. It's not the Soviet Union of the Cold War. It's not just Japan of the 1980s. It's a mix of the two. It's economic, it's military, and now in terms of technology, who is going to dominate the technologies of the future? Automation, robotics, semiconductors, artificial intelligence, additive manufacturing. These are areas where both Chinese companies and American companies are very, very active in this space. Technology is rapidly becoming a new vector of competition in the U.S.-China relationship. Fourth, anomaly. China's an anomaly. Political scientists will tell you, well, either China's a revisionist state or a status quo state. Right? Those are sort of the binary choices that political scientists will give you. I hate to disappoint you. China is both and neither at the same time. There are elements of China's behavior that's very revisionist. China is profoundly uncomfortable with its territorial claims. And when it comes to issues related to territorial disputes in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, Taiwan, etc., China is very revisionist. It totally rejects the principles based on the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is sort of the rules and norms that guide territorial disputes. On economics, it's a much more mixed picture. China is a member of most of the major international economic organizations and has been supporting them. In some limited instances, China has created new organizations, like the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. But the reality is the way that that institution was structured, the way it's operating, is much more supportive of the Bretton Woods institutions than it is creating a parallel set of institutions. China has put forward this big new idea, the Belt and Road Initiative, to create connectivity across the Eurasian landmass. It's unclear whether or not that is going to be a truly revisionist type of institution or initiative. So in many ways, you know, when I'm trying to figure out a tough geopolitical problem, is China a status quo power? Is it a revisionist power? I always go to sort of the great minds in international relations. And in this instance, the great mind is Stephen Colbert. I know, you thought I was going to say Henry Kissinger, didn't you? Yeah, Stephen Colbert. You know, what does he call China? A frenemy. In other words, it's a country that sees its interests as tied to key aspects of the international system. It sees itself dissatisfied with some aspects of the international system, but it's worried about changing them because that actually might compromise their interests, whereas in other areas, it's actually trying to undermine rules, norms, and institutions. So China defies easy characterization, and I would encourage you to be critical when you look at blanket statements about China. Fifth, confidence. Xi Jinping is a supremely confident Chinese leader. I know. I probably spent 40 hours in meetings with him, with Vice President Biden, with President Obama, and other American leaders. I saw the shift from Hu Jintao to Xi Jinping. He's a different Chinese leader. He's managed to consolidate power far more rapidly than in any of his predecessors. He's put himself as equivalent to Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping. And now the Chinese talk about this current period in international relations as a historic opportunity, an opportunity in which the economic theories and political theories of the West, including the United States, have proven to be flawed. The Chinese talk about the democratic deficit, the governance deficit, the developmental deficit of the West. They point to the global financial crisis, and they talk about China's experience, how China has maintained very consistent and substantial growth in the last decade, and that now is this great opportunity for China. And then, of course, lastly, keep in mind America's strengths. Steve Walt did a great job reminding us that America has geography on its side. America has allies on its side. America has energy dominance on its side. So never forget that there are an enormous number of inherent strengths within the United States, and it's important to juxtapose those. So Trump generates trepidation in Asia. This is simply to highlight we're in a current period where because of the policies chosen by the Trump administration, the withdrawal from TPP, the withdrawal from Paris, the fact that Trump appears very highly protectionist at home, the Chinese are having a tough time communicating with the Trump administration, it's clear that the United States is on the back foot in the Asia Pacific, which only creates a more permissive environment for the Chinese to push their agendas and their policies in the region. So in terms of China's rise, there's a lot happening. What does this mean for the U.S.-China relationship? First, keep in mind this is a relationship that has existed for 40 years. Actually, in January of next year is going to be the anniversary of the normalization of relations. So we've now spent twice as much time interacting with China formally in a bilateral relationship than we have during the 20 years of alienation, estrangement, and antagonism that we did during the Cold War. And so this is a long-standing relationship with a lot of experience and a lot of interaction. U.S. perceptions of China. Number one, the victim mentality. Many Americans, when we assess China's view of the world, China very much thinks of itself as having been the victim of 100 years of shame and humiliation, beginning with the Opium War and ending in 1949 when Mao founded China. China believes that that it is entitled to be a rising power. So you have this very, very wicked combination of a victim mentality and an entitlement mentality at the same time. China's dissatisfied with the international system. It's dissatisfied with its role. And on issues like territorial disputes, on certain trade issues where it feels that rules, norms, and institutions are allied against China, the Chinese are interested in revising them and changing them. China absolutely seeks to limit U.S. influence in Asia, especially when the Chinese believe that institutions like the U.S. alliances with Japan and in Korea undermine China's space. And then under Xi Jinping, China has decided to be a little bit more aggressive and assertive. Look no further than China's behavior in the South China Sea. Now, of course, those competitive views on the U.S. side are matched by very competitive views on the Chinese side. Most Chinese see the United States as a declining power. Chinese will debate about how rapidly declining, but the trajectory is one of declining, and it's trying to hold on to its status. They believe that most Americans seek to contain China's rise, that there's no conditions under which America could sort of comfortably accept cooperating with China. The U.S. doesn't respect China's political system. I mean, pretty much every meeting I had with a Chinese leader for my six years at the NSC, they always begin the meeting by saying, we want to be treated as an equal. And we would say, we do treat you as an equal. But nonetheless, the fact that there is an underlying feeling that the U.S. simply doesn't respect their political system eats away at the whole issue of trust and confidence in the relationship. And then lastly is a core issue that the Chinese have a hard time reconciling, which is the United States is key to China's success. For Xi Jinping to achieve his goal, to achieve the China dream by 2049, the United States is essential. We're China's largest economic partner. A war with the United States would fundamentally derail the whole process of China's rise. But the United States is also the biggest threat to China's success. And that duality, the tension between those two, is at the heart of the interactions and the relationship. So let me talk to you a little bit about where we are in the U.S.-China relationship. And I divide this up into cyclical and short-term factors and structural and long-term factors. It's sort of the approach that economists like to use to separate the short-term and the long-term. In terms of the cyclical short-term factors, number one, we have a very narrow bilateral agenda. The Trump administration is really working on two issues with China, trade and North Korea. When you ask them, are you interested in cooperating with China on issues, whether it's climate change or terrorism or public health or global economic growth, they're really not that interested. They frame China as a strategic competitor. I recommend everybody go take a look, read through the new national security strategy. They've identified China as a strategic competitor. They lump China together with Russia, called them both revisionist states. In basically every domain in every region of the world, they talk about strategic competition with China. You can imagine what kind of signal that sends to the Chinese. But at the same time, there's this weird dynamic where Trump has this very strong personal affinity for Xi Jinping. Go and watch the press conference that Trump had with Xi Jinping during his state visit. I mean, he really genuinely likes this guy because he likes sort of what he believes are strong, resolute leaders. And it's unclear what this personal affinity is going to do, how it's going to affect management of the relationship. Weak communication mechanisms. Unfortunately, the Trump administration and the Chinese have not really been able to come up with a good set of mechanisms to communicate on defense affairs, on diplomatic affairs, on economic affairs, in part because the Trump administration sees dialogue and talking as a sign of weakness and a way to be manipulated by the Chinese. I just simply fundamentally disagree with that proposition. I wrote some of the original papers in the Obama administration in 2009, how we had to come up with a very sophisticated communication system, because given the complexity, given the layers to the U.S.-China relationship, if you don't have clear, consistent, and credible communication, you're not going to be able to get big pieces of business done, like managing the U.S. and Chinese response to the global financial crisis in the 2009-2010 time period, or, God forbid, manage a nuclear crisis with North Korea. And, of course, this creates all sorts of uncertainty about the U.S. role in Asia. This is mixed with long-term structural dynamics. Point one, we simply have to get used to the fact that the U.S.-China relationship is going to be a mix of cooperation and competition. And the competitive dimensions of the relationship are intensifying. In other words, there's no easy model that the U.S.-China relationship is going to fit into. I told you they're neither a revisionist state nor a status quo state, but sort of an element of two. We talked about Stephen Colbert's frenemy idea. The U.S.-China relationship is probably going to be one of sort of long-term, intensive competition with episodic cooperation. Economic relations in the business community are no longer the ballast and propeller of the relationship. For the first 30, 35 years, it was the business community that always ensured that there was a core set of actors in the United States keeping the relationship on an even keel. That is fading away. There's growing concern in the United States about Chinese political influence in the U.S. media, in U.S. education institutions. For those of you that read The Economist, a few weeks ago there was an issue that talked about sharp power, highlighting Chinese political influences in democracies like Australia, New Zealand, Germany, the U.K., that's coming to the United States. Xi Jinping is much more active in shaping regional and global affairs. The U.S. is profoundly uncomfortable. The United States has not come to an understanding either among the Trump administration or among the broader elites about what the power relationship should be like between the United States and China in Asia or the world. And then Xi Jinping is very comfortable with friction and risk in the U.S.-China relationship. This is very new for the United States. You have a Chinese leader that's willing to take initiatives, throw a few elbows, throw a few punches in the U.S.-China relationship, like building artificial islands in the South China Sea as a way to assert its interests, even though he knows it's going to cause problems in the U.S.-China relationship. But there's also a positive side of the balance sheet. This is a profoundly mature relationship. As I said, we've had official diplomatic relations for 40 years. We've been in contact for another 10 when Kissinger and Nixon reached out in 1971. They know us and we know them. Very mature relationship. There are decades of diplomats and specialists like myself on both sides that are constantly talking about all of these issues. Number two, density. Deep, deep, dense ties between the business communities, between people. There are about 350,000 to 400,000 Chinese students studying in the United States at any time. There are about 50,000 Americans studying in China. There are hundreds of American businesses either invested in and producing goods in China or linked to supply chains with Chinese manufacturers. So these are dense connections. The connections between us are expanding. One of the great contradictions at the heart of the U.S.-China relationship is even as it becomes more competitive, even as U.S. concerns about China grow, Chinese investment in the United States is growing. You talk to mayors and governors, and they love Chinese investment. They want more of it. Why? Because it creates jobs in America. It keeps factories producing in the United States. So I see the relationship as one that is at once unstable because there are these multiple sources of friction, because the sources of competition are growing, the communication is not really good, but it's also a very resilient relationship. In other words, it can become unstable, we can have problems, but these problems are fixable because of the mutual interests of both sides, because the fact that, normally speaking, we have very, very capable managers on both sides. And it's profoundly in American and Chinese interests to manage this underlying competition. Key events to watch in the future. 2018 is going to be a very important year for the U.S.-China relationship. Trump is preparing some very, very aggressive trade actions against the Chinese because of forced technology transfer, because of lack of respect for intellectual property, theft that probably goes into the billions. So Trump's going to take some trade actions, and the Chinese will retaliate. And we'll see how much of an action-reaction dynamic plays out. We'll see whether or not we can come up with some kind of diplomatic or negotiated solution. Number two, the Indo-Pacific strategy. This is Trump's big strategy to expand U.S. influence in the Asia-Pacific. There's only one problem. There's nothing there. It's a bumper sticker as part of their strategy. Where's the beef? They haven't articulated. They did the worst thing possible as a policymaker. They announced a policy without actually having developed it first. So let's see how much they can do. North Korea, enough said. And then lastly, Chinese maritime behavior. Chinese assertiveness in the East China Sea and the South China Sea is extraordinarily problematic. As I said, it's undermining a key set of norms and rules that underpin stability in the international system. But yet, nonetheless, the Chinese have been very effective at advancing their interests and sort of changing facts on the ground through their creation of these artificial islands, which they're gradually building up. And they may choose to militarize by actively deploying forces there. So what does that mean for the Asia-Pacific? I'm over time, so I'll finish up very quickly. The core strategic reality of the Asia-Pacific is that, on the one hand, no one in the Asia-Pacific, Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia, China, no one wants China to dominate because they're profoundly uncomfortable about what Chinese hegemony would mean for them. But on the other hand, nobody wants to choose between the United States and China, and nobody wants to be brought into a U.S. containment strategy. And essentially, the strategic reality, what is going to play out in Asia over the next several decades, will basically essentially be between those two poles. What does that mean for U.S.-China relations? Basically, I see a relationship in which the United States and China will, through a series of unplanned interactions and decisions, essentially try and grope towards a geopolitical modus vivendi for a stable relationship, which will create an inherently unstable equilibrium. It will be an equilibrium, but it'll be incredibly unstable because neither the United States nor China has come up with or will likely come up with an internal decision about what their respective roles and places will be in the Asia-Pacific. Gone are the days of Potsdam and Yalta, where you could have big leaders sit down and talk about power sharing. So essentially, you're going to have this very sort of haphazard process by which these two major powers try and grope towards this kind of equilibrium. At the same time that you have middle powers, Japan, India, and Vietnam, who are active, capable, and want to play a greater role in the region. That's an enormous opportunity for the United States if the United States grasps it. At the same time, you have huge forces unfolding in the Asia Pacific. You have this strange situation of a high degree of economic integration, more trade and investment interaction, at the same time that you have security fragmentation. Most political scientists' heads would just explode because political science and international relations will tell you the two cannot go hand in hand. And the relationship between economics and security really will determine the scope of power relationships going forward. And then lastly, North Korea, which I haven't touched on in detail. Essentially, the next big potential reordering moment in the Asia-Pacific is going to be North Korea, especially if a war results. And I think there's probably 20 to 25% chance of U.S. military action over North Korea. There are no good solutions. The United States may well have to very grudgingly, unsatisfactorily accept North Korea as a de facto nuclear weapon state in order to cap and freeze the program. I don't want that. I spent 6 years trying to prevent that. But the options are so limited at that point. So with that, let me thank you very much for your attention.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. That was just Evan Medeiros speaking at the 31st Annual Camden Conference discussing U.S.-China relations. You can hear his talk again anytime by visiting mainepublic.org.